Dear Ajahn, can lay people become arahant? Can lay people get enlightened? Is becoming a monk nun the only way or the quickest way to get enlightened? Yes, exactly. Next question. No, you can become enlightened as a lay person. You don't need to get an aircraft to go back to Indonesia or Hong Kong. You can walk all the way to the north of Australia to Darwin. And there you can get a boat across the little islands of Indonesia, and if you're Indonesian you can stop halfway. And then you can get another bicycle, and you can bicycle all the way up through Malaysia and Thailand over to Cambodia and up Vietnam and into China. And you can just go to Hong Kong on a bicycle. That's possible, but I would not recommend it. I would recommend getting an aircraft. So yes, it's possible to become fully enlightened as a lay person, but I wouldn't recommend it. When there is Buddha air, in other words, the Sangha, the fast way, the quick way, the convenient way, thanks to the great compassion of the Lord Buddha. That's why we have monks and nuns. This is the quick and easy way. You can do it, just the same as you can walk all the way to Hong Kong, just about, with a few boats, but not recommended. And why not become a monk or a nun? It's a wonderful life. Isn't that right, Venables? Yes? Yes. You see, the happy monks. Now, maybe some of you may think, oh, I'm a bit old now. Oh, I've got all of these commitments, wife, husband, children, parents. But then, now and again, you have a child, a son or a daughter, who wants to ordain. And you stop them. I remember the people saying this, Chinese people especially, they're very happy and inspired when someone goes forth and becomes a monk or a nun. As long as it's not their son and daughter. Other people, yes, but not mine. Because somehow or other you get sort of embarrassed. You think that they've done something wrong or you've done something wrong. No, this should be one of the career choices. That when your son or daughter comes and said, Mummy, I want to become a nun, a bhikkhuni. You should be so proud. Say, well done. Your son comes along and says, I want to ordain as a bhikkhu. Say, wonderful, great. Because there's so many doctors in this world. There's many engineers. There's plenty of business people. But what do we need more than anything else in our world? Really good monks and nuns. Especially in poor Indonesia. You know, you have monks in Indonesia. The one monk looks after, I don't know how many temples. How many temples does this venerable look after? Only one. Lots. You see, lots. So it's not all like in Bodhinyana where we've got 22 monks today. They're just that staying over there and a few over here. This is a very rare monastery, especially in the West, having so many bhikkhus. So we need more. We need very many more in Indonesia. We also could do with more in Hong Kong as well. So, if that's your son and daughter, and they say, Daddy, I want to become monk. Yes, that's my boy. So, look, please encourage them. It's a really good lifestyle. Dear Ajahn, will metta work on a mentally unsound person? The metta worked on Nalagiri the elephant, and Nalagiri was mentally unsound. It was an elephant, it was drunk. If it can work on an elephant, surely it can work on many people who are mentally unsound. It does actually work, because sometimes people who are mentally unsound, you know, they cannot reason, but they can certainly, they can feel their emotions, and many of them have a lot of fear. But if you give them kindness, it does actually settle them down quite a lot. So if someone is mentally unsound, just emotionally, sometimes they're very, very good. When I was, some of my stories, when I was at Cambridge, I had a couple of friends. I was the only Buddhist, I knew a few other Buddhists there. But there weren't that many Buddhists. And so a couple of my friends were Christians. And they told me one day they were going to do voluntary service at the local home for the mentally disabled. And when they told me that that's what Christians do, they do a lot of social service, I thought, well, I'm a Buddhist, I should do my bit too. So I volunteered to go with them to do this voluntary service one afternoon a week. Now, I must admit that you shouldn't be proud of me, because I wasn't doing this out of compassion. I was just doing this to keep up with the Joneses. If the Christians do it, the Buddhists can as well. And that's the only reason I went there, honestly. So I went along with them. But, you know, those Christians only lasted a couple of weeks. I went there for 2 years. Every afternoon, I think Thursday afternoon, full-blown hospital. And I was working with the Down syndrome children. And actually, some of them were adults, maybe like young people, you call them. And I thought, like everybody else who does some social service, I thought I was giving. Ha ha ha. I was learning. I got so much from that experience. What I learned there, those were people who had, you know, say mental disability, emotional disturbance of being Down syndrome. But they were emotionally just so sharp. And I would go there in an afternoon, I'd just spoken up with my girlfriend the night before. They would see that straight away, they'd come and give me a hug. I don't know how they knew that. They could actually, emotionally, they were just so sensitive. And so to this day I say, any of my emotional intelligence, I learned a lot of that from those Down syndrome people. Spent 2 years, you know, one day a week with them. And I found out these people were just so sharp. They were not good rationally. Sometimes they could not string a couple of sentences together. But they were very good feel, and they knew when I was upset or when I was relaxed, straight away. So their emotional intelligence was brilliant. Which is one of the reasons why there's many people, you know, you look at them as mentally impaired. They're not so much mentally impaired as rationally impaired. They can't actually speak on the same sort of level, but sometimes they compensate, and they're emotionally very, very sharp. And to this day I say that they were much more emotionally balanced than those Nobel Prize winning chemists which I knew in Cambridge. They were a real mess. But these guys and girls, they were just so sharp. So yes, metta can work on the emotionally disturbed. In fact, very, very, and on the, what you call mentally disturbed. Because it's just one part of their brain isn't working, another part is very sensitive. So yeah, absolutely. That's from experience. Dear Ajahn, I took abortions decades ago, long before I became a Buddhist. Now that I know I will go to hell for this wrong deed. You won't go to hell. I promise and guarantee that you are free. I can give you a get out of hell free card. Did you remember playing Monopoly as a kid? Get out of jail free card. I can give you a get out of hell free card. This bothered me a lot. How could I not think of the past and future? It's always come to me when I meditate. Look, number one, the Buddha, this is a little bit of academic Buddhism. When does life begin? And human life begin? And the Buddha actually made it very clear that human life begins when the first consciousness manifests in the mother's womb. That's actually what the Buddha said. Now that's a very powerful statement. It's when it manifests, when it appears in that being growing in a mother's womb. And for consciousness to appear, this is basic Buddhism, you also have to have the other khandhas, especially things like vedana, the ability to experience pleasure or pain. And so what the Buddha was saying there, that when that being in the mother's womb can actually manifest pleasure or pain. In other words, it does move away from painful stimuluses and go towards pleasurable stimuluses. You say then, that is a human being. Before that time, they are not, they don't qualify. And you ask any gynecologist, and they will actually tell you, to actually have that pleasure and pain, you do need to have the nervous system develop in that fetus. And I forget the number of weeks which that takes for actually the nervous system, but nearly all abortions are taken before that happens. So you can be quite certain, you know, unless it was a very extraordinary late-term abortion, that the person in that womb was not a human being. It didn't qualify according to the Buddha's statement. You did not kill. It hadn't developed yet into the human being. So sometimes, you know, well, it's part of my body. Yeah, you might have amputated finger. You're killing part of your body, your finger. You know, is that going to take you to hell? You know, if you have your tonsils out, which I did, that's killing part of me. You know, is that going to send me to hell? Of course not. Until this time, that little being is part of the mother, according to Buddhism. It shares the consciousness of the mother until the new consciousness actually manifests in it. So that is a little bit of academic argument from the original teachings of the Buddha. And I like that argument simply because it does take away a lot of the superstitious guilt and pain of girls who commit abortions. And number two, even if it is a late-term abortion, you know, it is a very, very different than that's, you know, getting a gun and killing sort of, you know, the lover of your wife, you know, out of anger. It's very, very different than sort of like a robber killing somebody. Now those are the types of killings which do, you know, even in law, they do actually attract very, very heavy penalties. It's murder. And you cannot equate the murder of a human being, you know, in sort of such situations, a developed a human being, you cannot equate that with abortion. It's a totally different ballgame. So even though Buddhism says we know we shouldn't kill, abortions are something very, very different, especially the early term abortions. And you will find that the reason why most women are paying attention, nearly every woman in this room has had an abortion, not everybody, but a lot of you have. And who says it's wrong? Mostly the people who tell you it's wrong and the people who tell you you'll go to hell are men. And they've never had an abortion. They don't know what it's like. Why do you women always believe what men says when they don't know what they're talking about? Now you are in a very difficult situation there. There's a being growing in your womb. And you don't know sort of, you know, what, you know, basically what's going to happen. And you're put in very difficult situations. Situations maybe because, you know, you just cannot sort of look after that being. Maybe it's because, you know, you're not sort of married. It creates all sorts of social pressures or financial pressures and all sorts of other pressures. There's so many reasons why you terminate early. And as far as Buddhism is concerned, I put my hand up here as a senior Buddhist. Early term abortions, no bad. The reason I say it's not bad is because karma, the essence of karma is intention. It's not so much what you do as why you do it. And talking to many women who have had abortions, it's not an easy decision. They do not make it lightly. And it's not usually done out of ill will or out of heedlessness. They consider that abortion just so deeply. And their intention, however it's composed, is always they're trying to do the best for everyone, including themselves. It's not ill will, it's not greed, it's not stupidity. The qualities which make it bad karma are absent in most abortions. You don't do it heedlessly, you don't do it, I don't like babies, kill it. You know, you think about that, you worry about it before, you worry about it afterwards. So it does not qualify as bad karma. Certainly not the sort of karma which will get you to hell. Absolutely not. So when I say that, I'm saying it because there's so much superstitious belief. And some of it comes from monks, unfortunately, who don't know their sutras, who don't go to the Buddha's teachings, but just go to what they heard from somebody else. Just hearsay. And I come along here because I'm a Western monk, I can challenge everything. Westerners were trained in Ahipassico. Come and see, look it for yourself. Work it out for yourself. Don't just believe it because you heard it somewhere. Check it out. And when a monk like me checks it out, no, it's not the sort of karma which sends you to hell. And a lot of time it's not bad karma at all, because you don't have the wrong intentions. You try and do the best by everybody. I know that once I was visiting my mother, and she was watching the news on TV. I was sitting next to her watching the news too. And there was this very fascinating case in, I think, Cardiff Hospital in England at the time. There was a woman with twins, two fetuses in her womb. And the doctors had all figured out, not just one opinion, but many opinions, and they all agreed without any doubt that if they did not intervene, the type of pregnancy was such, both of the fetuses would die and so would the mother. That was one option. Doing nothing, they were absolutely sure as you could be in medicine, many, many doctors all agreeing that everyone would die. But if they did an abortion on one of those fetuses, the other one would survive and so would the mother. And so there was an ethical dilemma. Should you kill one of the fetuses so the other two, the fetus and the mother, could survive? Now, you are Buddhists, some of you, most of you, and you try and keep your precepts. What would you do if you were the doctor and had duty of care, that you could not just make no decision? Making no decision was a decision, it would kill everybody. Or you had the decision to kill one of those beings in the womb. What would be the moral choice you would make? Put your hand up if you would kill one of the fetuses in the womb to save the other two. And I put my hand up as well. That is a moral decision. And that was a very fascinating case, because there were some, I would call them extremists, religious people, especially the Christians. No, it's bad to kill. Leave it up to God. And that three people would die for sure. So they'd all die. So this was a very good little case there. It's very rare this happens. Very rare. But sometimes you can see there was a case. It was morally justified. Good karma to abort one of those children. Clearly. Now I say that because it challenges. Karma is just not that easy to understand. You've got to go to the root of it. The intentions. What are you doing this for? What's the outcome? So the intention there was that, actually the doctor did it. Before anybody could argue with him, he just aborted one of the kids so the mother and the other one survived. So, what is the intention there? His intention there was not to kill the kid, but to save two people. That was the main reason he did an operation. Saving two or killing one. You can think that's a difficult decision to make, but that was why it was ethically good. His main reason was to save. And sometimes that's what you do if you have an abortion. Just to try and do the best for everybody concerned. You're not able to look after the kid. It's not the right time. You may have actually women being raped. And imagine that prolongs the trauma of the unlawful sexual intercourse somebody forced on you, made you pregnant. So there's all these different considerations. And so I go on length here because that's almost like a mission for me. I feel guilty in that sense that men give women such a hard time on abortions. And you do not deserve that. And as a Buddhist, you should not feel guilty. understand the karma more deeply, you've done nothing wrong, you certainly will not go to hell. Guaranteed. Ajahn Brahm says. Thank you for that question, that's good. How to avoid drowsiness during meditation, please? Cup of coffee? Cup of tea? Okay, sometimes it's obviously make sure you sleep well at night. And again, you know, there's a lot of insomnia in our current world. And a lot of times that people cure insomnia through mindfulness practice. So when you go to bed tonight, don't just go to sleep and start thinking about things. Practice the first stages of meditation, present moment awareness. How can you do that? Now, how many of you sleep in bed with your shoes on or slippers on? Any of you do? You take your slippers off before you get into bed. So as you take your slippers off before you go into bed, let the left slipper represent your past. Think that that's your past. You take the slipper off and put it under your bed. And as you take off the right slipper, just imagine your right slipper is your future. And you take that off and put it under your bed. And you never take the past and future into bed with you. That's a dirty habit. Like taking your shoes into bed. Which means if you identify the left shoe with the past, the right shoe with the future, just do that little imagination. It means when you go into bed, you're not carrying of all the stuff which happened to you so far today. And all of the worries, anxieties, fears of the future, you don't take that into bed with you either. Which means that the cause of so much insomnia, worry about the future, lingering, being hurt about the past, doesn't go into bed with you. So you can really relax and have a very beautiful deep sleep. And just simple things like that help you relax enough to get a good night's sleep. You know, there's not that many people sleep well. Which is one of the reasons why you've only got in the current world where so much is asked of you, you have to work hard, get up early, get to the work on time. So much you have to do every day. So you really need to learn how to sleep well. So the few hours you do have in bed, you make the best use of. And if you can sleep well, just imagine just how much energy you will have in life. And how much health you will have. There are so many sicknesses come from tiredness. Cancers, cardiac problems. And just so much other stuff. Grumpiness, not being able to have a good relationship with anybody because you're just bleh. Now so much stuff comes from just a simple thing, like not learning how to sleep well. So, here, just that simple exercise. Let go of past, let go of future. You go in there and just nothing to worry about at all. And you can have a very good night's sleep. And also it means you don't have all these dreams which, you know, activate your brain. You know, you can sleep deeply and peacefully. And the other thing to do is just, you know, practice that letting go, making peace, being kind, being gentle as you go to sleep. Make peace with yourself. Be kind to your body. Really relax it. Kind to your mind. And be very gentle. And that's what you take into sleep with you. Making peace, kindness, gentleness. If you have any dreams, you have these beautiful, soft, kind dreams. And you wake up, feel so refreshed. And that's the sort of thing you can do. And if you can do things like that, you don't get even sleepy during the meditation. If you do, it's just because you've been working extra hard. So just accept that. But the sleepiness gets reduced enormously. And your happiness and health increases. So try that. Learn how to sleep on this retreat. Sleep deeply, sleep well, sleep softly, peacefully, kind, gently. Like in the second factor of the Eightfold Path. It doesn't just lead to nirvana. It leads to deep, peaceful sleep. Good questions tonight. Dear Ajahn, can you take us through a 10-minute guided meditation to directly experience the practice according to your teachings? Yes, I can do that. Next question. That's the question you asked, but I can do it. Now, if you want to do that, it takes a bit too much time here. And if I give a guided meditation here, some of you are slow, some of you are fast, and you can't do what they call a one-size-fits-all guided meditation. So instead of that, when you get home, or maybe even now, there's Wi-Fi available here, if you can ask people like Daniel or Burr or Lai Peng, now, is there on the internet a guided meditation which you can download on your smartphone? And there's many of those. And you can actually listen to a few of them, maybe on the internet when you go home. Find one which you really like. Download it on your smartphone, and you can just put your earplugs in. Whenever you want to do a guided meditation, it's there for you. These smartphones have got a lot of good apps, and having a sort of guided meditation on your smartphone is brilliant for you. Because what that means, it might be myself or one of the other nuns or monks, you know, that you can actually hear them anytime you like. You may be waiting for a plane to go off somewhere, or you may be just waiting at the doctor's, you may be stressed out with something or other. You put the iPhone in and it guides you into a nice deep meditation. It's very, very helpful. So download some from the internet. There's lots available. Please share more about empathy and respect, not only for human beings, but also to other beings. Because this afternoon I found one roll of the toilet paper mess in the secret garden. So somebody was actually using the secret garden as a toilet. So that must have been the kangaroos. No kangaroos have to go to the toilet. So maybe they've been hanging around the monks long enough, they started to use the toilet paper as well. Well, they've got to do something to wipe their backside, who knows? So this afternoon I found one roll of the toilet paper mess in the secret garden. There's a little Buddha statue with a nice little garden somewhere in these grounds. We call it a secret garden because, you know, it's a bit hard to find, but if you walk around long enough, you'll find it. And just, you try and keep it nice and clean. I don't know why somebody did that, but if they did that, they had to do that. For some reason or another, I don't know why, but give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't know why they were doing that. Maybe they had diarrhea and had to do an emergency. Who knows why they did that? Maybe they did that because there was a Zen master teaching you a lesson. I don't know what the lessons are because I don't understand Zen masters. But it may be a koan for you. But whatever it is, you know, why do you allow the mess to make a mess in your mind and in your heart? Leave the mess out there in the world. Don't pick it up and put it in your heart. Because people do that. This is a problem. It's the opposite of empathy when we get angry or disgusted. Somebody does something really dirty, mean, nasty, and we allow that to come right into our heart and we keep it. It's like putting the dirty toilet paper inside here. It's not the right place for it. So if that was me, I'd take that toilet paper, take it away, take it to the toilet and flush it. And I thank the person for giving me the opportunity of making such wonderful good karma that I could now clean that garden up. Thank you for giving me that opportunity. And that's how I would deal with it. Never get angry at other people, but if someone gets angry at you, they're giving you an opportunity to just see how far your practice has gone. See whether you can practice compassion, even though they're being mean and nasty to you. They are your teacher. Because when I was in Thailand and had all these mosquitoes biting, I was very angry at the mosquito, until Ajahn Chah told me, call those Ajahn mosquitoes. They are your teachers. They are teaching you to deal with irritation, because life is irritating. You get a husband, it's irritating. You get a wife, they're irritating. Parents are irritating. Kids are really irritating. Everybody is irritating. That's their nature. And they teach you how to be peaceful even when things are irritating you. It's a lesson you have to learn. So whatever happens in this life, which is irritating, which is bad, it's only toilet paper. No, they're not shoving it in your mouth. So it's not that bad. So see if you can just, you know, pick it up, take it away. And then give them the benefit of the doubt and say, thank you, teacher. I don't know why you did that, but it was a wonderful thing. Please tell a ghost story. Thank you. Is it not here? I'll do that just before we leave, so we can turn off the lights. You do like that, huh? Okay. Because we're talking about, we told a lot of ghost stories just with the monks at 6 to 7. When I meditate, I sometimes feel that something wants to come out from my forehead. What is it? Probably sweat. There's nothing going to come out of your forehead. So it's just, when those things happen, you just, oh, this is interesting. Just make peace with it. Be kind to it. Be gentle. And just watch it. Because when anything weird happens, you know, if you fight it and get worried about it, it does become an anger-eating monster. And it becomes this really big stuff, and you really get scared, and, what's going on? Is some alien has impregnated my brain, and the alien is now beginning to gestate, and it's going to burst out. People can feel that, you know, and they just get into these amazing fantasies. And it gets a big thing, and it's just a feeling at first, it's just a perception, just, you know, forget about it, it's interesting, it's weird, let it happen, and just, it vanishes very quickly. But when you get worried about it, it keeps going on a long time. Could it be more effort in meditation for persons living in a family environment? Kindness is there, but could it be possible an attached care? Okay, when you have a family, you're always attached to the family. And it's just, that's what family are like. But it's not a bad thing to be attached to, because as well as being attached to the family, it also means you have to let go of yourself. In a family, you have to let go of what you want, you know, for your partner, for your kids, for your parents. So there is a lot of renunciation when you live in a family. You try that, you live alone, and then you go and live with others, and there's so many things you just cannot do which you normally would do. Now you have to sacrifice for others. So there is something beautiful in family life as well. It's one of the things I could never figure out. Why is it when people get married, they always want a monk or a priest to give them a blessing? Have you noticed in the Christian church, priests are celibate, monks are celibate, we've never been married, but you want us to give you advice? Because even in a marriage, it's not just about the sex. Now, there is something, you know, spiritual about a relationship when you commit to another person. Because it's not just committing to another person, you're letting go of yourself. And you're merging into something bigger than you, you know, the partnership. There is something sort of spiritual and holy there. And this is actually just one of the reasons why, that, yeah, there's attachment there, but there's a lot of letting go at the same time in a family. You ask any mother who has had a kid, just the amount of stuff you have to let go of. You don't sleep well for a couple of years. That baby cries, and you don't think of yourself. You get up and look after that baby, any time of the day or night. And, you know, you're sick, but you still look after that baby. And that's a wonderful thing to see, just how, as they said in the chant, how a mother will give up her life for her child. That's how much they can let go. That is why there's something very beautiful in that. So it's not just about attachment, having a family. There's attachment, but it's also letting go. So, more effort in meditation with persons living in family environment? No. Just, you have too much effort in your life. Just lessen it and flow much more. Don't try and be a control freak in your family. Let your kids be your kids. Because if you put effort in, what you tend to do is to make your, as I gave this talk on Friday night, is try and make your kids really successful at school. They've got to come in the top 10%. They've got to go to university. And you've heard me say before, if your kid Your son, your daughter comes in the top 5% at school or university, or the bottom 5%, you are not good Buddhist parents. Even the top 10%, bottom 10%, that's, you're bad Buddhists. Because Buddhism, we believe in the middle way. If your child comes in the middle somewhere, well done, good Buddhist. Middle way is the best way. Because what that does, it takes a lot of pressure off your children. And that's the worst thing you could do to kids. You encourage them, but these days people don't encourage the kids, they pressure the kids. And those poor kids have such emotional trauma. Now they love mummy and daddy. And they're trying to do their best for their parents, and they just force themselves so much trying to meet their parents' expectations. They just can't do it. Get your kids to be in the middle somewhere. Get them to be happy. And happiness is success. How should we deal with loneliness? Thank you. I'm an expert on loneliness. I haven't got a partner. When you all go, who have I got to talk to? Will I miss you when you're gone? No way. Because I spent a lot of my time by myself. Know that once I spent 6 months on a retreat, over in the monastery, and I never saw another human being for 6 months. And I never spoke for 6 months. Honest. I never spoke to any human being for 6 months. And you think noble silence just for a few days is tough. 6 months I never spoke. But all that time, I was never lonely. Because I was with someone. I was with my best friend. Me. Because I am always with me. And because I have a good relationship to myself, I'm at peace with myself, I never feel lonely. Lonely people, it means they don't like being with themselves. They've got a bad relationship with themselves. So when there's no one else around, you're stuck with you. You have trouble because you haven't formed a good relationship with the one person you can never escape from. Yourself. Which is why I gave teachings like opening the door of your heart to yourself. Whoever you are, whatever you've done. And I haven't been perfect. I've made stupid mistakes in life. But I've opened the door of my heart to all the stupid things. You know, when I was young, I made a bomb in the park. I made a bomb with my mate. We're only about 10, 11 years of age. We got some stuff. I forget what it was. Put it in a tin can. And it went boom. Oh, I really was pleased about that. When it went boom, a little kid, a boy. Boom, it went. And I thought it was really great until we got caught by the park keeper. And that wasn't fun. I could have been a terrorist if I hadn't become a monk. You did all sorts of stupid things when you were a kid. But, you forgive yourself. That's part of who you are. So you open the door of your heart to yourself. So you know yourself so well and you're at peace with yourself. You don't have to be perfect to like yourself. In fact, the more perfect you are, the harder it is to like yourself. And if you want to know what I mean, it's an old story. I'm going to ask you tomorrow, if you don't understand this story straight away, tomorrow have a walk in the forest and find me a perfect tree. One which is dead straight, vertical, with all the branches equally spaced. With only green leaves and no brown leaves. You find me a perfect tree in this forest and you will be the first person ever to do that. Because all the trees in this forest are crooked. They're bent. Many of the branches have been broken off. And there's many brown and yellow leaves on there. And look at the bark, it's all scarred. That's what the real trees are. And they're my favourite ones. My favourite trees are the ones which are bent all over the place. They've really got character, they're lovely. And the ones which got scars on the bark. The ones which are damaged are the most beautiful. You don't have to be perfect to be beautiful. The damaged trees, they're the ones which belong in the natural forest where people love to have walks. So if you're damaged goods, you belong in the beautiful forest of our world. That's how you like yourself. With all the scars of your life so far, all the pain, all the mistakes, that makes you crooked. That makes you beautiful. So if you have a crooked husband, keep him, he's beautiful. If you've got a wife who's scarred, brilliant. And when you look at yourself and see all your crookedness and all your scars and all your broken branches, then you're a beautiful person. You appreciate that. Then you're never lonely. You're with this person you really respect and like, yourself. And then when you're with others, you can see their beauty too. So with others, by yourself, it's all the same. You're always with somebody. Next question, what is middle way and how to practice middle way in real life? There's an old Chinese saying, I don't know if you know that, that he who walks a middle path gets hit by traffic coming in both directions. So there's sometimes you've got to take, a decision. For example, when people are asking me for help, if I say yes, I will probably be burnt out. If I say no, I'll feel guilty. I have to choose between being compassionate to others or to myself. How to deal with such situations? There's always a third way. Because I get this a lot. People ask for help, and if I say yes to everything, if I accept every invitation you give to me, I couldn't do it, possibly. You can't be in three places at once. So, but if I say no, I mean, that's not fair, is it? I mean, that's just really mean, saying no. So what I do, you have an invitation, you ask me to help, I'll say, I will think about it. Or I'll get back to you. And that's not lying, because I've been thinking about some invitations for about 5 years now. I'll get back to you one day, if not this life, in the next life. So it's not lying. It's using smart speech to sort of get out of doing something. If in doubt, procrastinate. Now, procrastination is a wonderful thing which we should do more of. Because we're always doing so much and getting things done. Procrastinate. Leave it till tomorrow. One of my sayings, never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. And that's very deep. Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. There you go, you work so hard today and you're dead tomorrow. What a waste of time. So never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. Procrastinate and have some peace and enjoy life instead of getting all out of the way. So it's true that when people ask you for help, sometimes if you can do it, great. But if you can't, say no, I'm busy. Just like one of my favourite jokes. Now Buddhism have Buddhist jokes, real Buddhist jokes. One of my favourite Buddhist jokes, probably the favourite Buddhist joke, is a man who, did I tell this earlier, rang up the Buddhist monastery? And then rang up the Buddhist, can you come and do some chanting at my temple? I think I did, didn't I? Yeah. Just very quickly in case, because there's a lot of people here who are very old. They're forgetting what I said at the beginning of the retreat. So the story just rang up the temple. Can you come and do some chanting in my house? No, I can't. I'm busy. What are you doing? I'm doing nothing. That's what monks are supposed to do. We're supposed to be meditating, doing nothing. Very good. So he hung up and the next day rang again. And say, monk, can you come and do the chanting in my house? I rang you yesterday. No, I'm busy again today. What are you doing today? Nothing. That's what you're doing yesterday. But I'm not finished yet, said the monk. That's a very lovely joke. Get nothing out of the way first of all.
and then do all the other work. So on the list of the stuff, when you, if you do a list, what you've got to do today. Number one, nothing. And get that finished, first of all, before you go on to something else. Because, you know, it was about 3 or 4 months ago, this Christian came up to me, and he said this very profound saying. He said, nothing is better than God. And I said, yes, you're right. I agree with you. Nothing is far higher than any God. That's not what they meant, though. They were very upset with me. So you have to balance things. When we talk about right diligence, we usually think about doing a lot in our practice, but sometimes we feel pushed and feel harsh if we need to do a lot. What is real right diligence then? Be diligent doing nothing. Be someone who's very, very committed to doing nothing. And put a lot of your effort into doing nothing. Give a lot of your time. That's what diligence is. Spend a lot of time doing nothing. Be diligent, nothing doing. Can you do that? You've got to put a lot of time into doing nothing. Otherwise it's not diligence. It actually does take effort to do nothing. Weird, but it's true. Because we are so much doers, controllers, walkers. We're always travelling somewhere, going somewhere. We're hardly ever being here. I don't know, what day is it today? It's Tuesday. When are you going back to Indonesia, to Hong Kong? Have you already started planning what you're going to do? Some of you, even though it's 2 or 3 days, some of you have already started packing. Amazing, it's true, they do. At least thinking about what you're going to pack, what you're going to take. Isn't that ridiculous? So please, do not pack your bags, none of them, until no earlier than 1 hour before you leave. Try that. You're such fearful that you've got to do things so early in case you might miss this or miss that. Don't be afraid. You're missing out on life. Always just preparing for something in the future. Never really being here. Always being ahead of yourselves. And that's why I say that it's very rare to see a human being these days. You see humans going somewhere, but never actually being here. Going to the next meditation, going to get a cup of tea. When you get a cup of tea, you already finished it before you start drinking it. You start thinking what you're going to do next. Always going on to the next thing, never actually stopping and being here. So one of the great things of this place, you know, you stop, please. You know, every now and again, you just sit down and just watch the sunset or watch the stars. Don't do anything. And people ask you, what are you doing? Say, just being here. But what are you doing? Just being. Why do I have to keep doing things? Is it some precept I must always do something? There's no precepts. I'm just going to be. Be and not do anything at all. See if you could. That takes effort and a lot of skill and a lot of compassion. And then you find out how to be at peace. Even one of the problems with your meditation, you're always doing something when you're meditating. You're always wadding the breath. You're trying to calm the mind down. You're trying to get something. Stop doing things when you meditate. Naughty. Stop doing stuff. If you catch yourself doing anything when you're meditating, stop it. So you don't do meditation. Meditation is what happens when you stop doing things. So people say, how do I do meditation? Wrong question. You haven't understood what meditation is. You don't do meditation. Now, some time ago, somebody asked me, sort of, Ajahn Brahm, you talk all about these nimittas and these lights. You write about all the jhanas in your books. Have you actually achieved those, Ajahn Brahm? Can you get jhanas, Ajahn Brahm? And I put my hand up and say, Ajahn Brahm can't get jhanas. I make the confession from it. I can't do it. I can't meditate. I have to get out of the way first of all. Ajahn Brahm has to vanish. If there's any Ajahn Brahm there, meditation doesn't work. So this is the answer. I can't meditate. I vanish, and then meditation happens. The I, the me, that's the problem. So I disappear. Do absolutely nothing, and all these incredible states happen. That's the trick of meditation. Stop doing and controlling things. Disappear. And then meditation is so easy. You don't do meditation. Meditation is what happens when you don't do anything, when you vanish. How do I know if I'm ready to join the Sangha? If you write that question, you are ready. What is unconditional love? The teddy bear. That's teaching you unconditional love. That teddy bear, it can be hugged by anybody. And does that teddy bear ever complain? Does it say, you haven't had a shower today, you're smelly, leave me alone? Does it ever say, you are squeezing me too hard? Does the teddy bear ever complain? But the teddy bear always gives you love back. You squeeze the teddy bear and it's really nice. Oh, thank you, teddy bear. That gives you an indication of unconditional love. It loves you and it doesn't ask anything back in return. So you can have unconditional love for the present moment. Not asking anything from this moment. Not asking for jhanas, not asking for peace. Not asking for all your problems to disappear. That's not unconditional. That's doing business again. And people in Hong Kong are very good at doing business. And in Indonesia as well. I will meditate as long as I get jhana. That's the deal. If I don't get jhana, I'm not coming back here again. So if you're trying to get peace, if that's a business deal you're doing, I'll meditate as long as I get something out of this. It's not meditating, it's business again. Unconditional love. I'm going to meditate. I don't care if I get anything or nothing at all. I'm just giving. I'm unconditionally loving this moment. Unconditionally. No strings attached. Isn't that wonderful? And I was saying that I gave a talk once about unconditional giving. I say, you know that what would be really impressive if somebody, whenever they give a donation, if they give a blank check. They just say to BSWA, sign it and let me fill in the amount. And somebody actually did that. They got out their checkbook, they signed BSWA. They signed it and said, John Brown, you put in your amount, whatever you want. I was so proud of them. So you know what I wrote in there? I wrote in, because in the check you've got to put the words and the numbers as well. So I wrote in there, nothing. And I gave it back to him. And he's got it sort of laminated on his wall. It's really well done, because I don't want anything out of you. But he gave that with total trust, with unconditional love. And that was why it's such a beautiful thing. And if you give unconditional love, the reason I put nothing there is because no one would ever exploit that. They can't do anything stupid and demean. You know, that's such a beautiful gift of trust. That's why I put nothing back. You gave me everything. Everything you ever want. And I give you even more than everything. Nothing is bigger than everything. And that was a very beautiful little interchange there. So that's what unconditional love is. And unconditional love, it starts with yourself. To love yourself, even doesn't matter how stupid you are, how totally unenlightened you are, give yourself total unconditional love. With all the abortions you've done, all the stupid stuff, all the cheating, all of the speeding which you weren't caught for, give unconditional love totally to yourself. You're fat, you're old. I give myself unconditional love. I'm good enough as I am. That's why, as I say, as your heart gets bigger, so does your body. So I always say, I said this in Sri Lanka, I said, never trust a skinny monk. And there's a very skinny monk sitting next to me. Oh no! Yeah, you guys are wrong. You're a bit skinny, so get a bigger heart. Anyway, the ghost story one. Last question, then the ghost story. Dear Ajahn, thanks for your great teachings. The path is clear and we'll do accordingly. Just for curiosity, do you know your past lives? Is it true that every one of us will connect with our past life eventually? If I follow the path faithfully, it sounds scary to me at this moment. What is the use of remembering past stuff? Is it just for finishing the unfinished task? For your kind direction, please. I can remember my past life. Before I was a monk, I was Peter Betts, living in London, going to Cambridge. That's my past. But that's not what people want. People want to sort of know, where were you before? What country? What name were you? And I can't tell you those things, but I know that, you know, people do have their past life memories, but I can't say, because that's one of our rules. You know, and you can, I don't make this up, it's the eighth paticca, you can go and have a look at it. And one of the reasons we do that is because we're not supposed to let on exactly just the depth of our understanding. Because if I did, then say, oh, he's really special, and these other monks, you know, they have done nothing, they're hopeless. Because this is what happens when you do get that first-class monk, you know, the Aryans, meditate, remember past lives, and the ordinary stuff, the second-class monks. First year I was in Thailand with Ajahn Chah, the food was very disgusting. I mean, it really was bad. Even people who had travelled to many other places, they couldn't believe just what we had in the northeast of Thailand. Boiled frogs, there was grasshoppers, snails. The snails were the ones I hated the most because they were like eating erasers. You know, it's just really hard to eat, just disgusting. The food was very, very disgusting. But I remember just one day I was sitting in the dining hall at Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, and a car came in, you know, with the pickup trucks, the utes they call them in Australia, filled with pots of food, you know, from the city. Some rich man had decided to, you know, to make some food and bring it to the monks. And I realized, and it's from the city, this is going to be nice food today. Something I could eat. And when they came in, with all that food, you could smell it, you could see it. They came into the hall and says, is Ajahn Chah here today? And he was actually doing a ceremony in somebody's house. So we said, no, he's not. So he got back in the car and drove away with all that food. Now that really hurt. I was only a young monk, only 1 or 2 years. You saw all that food and they would not give it to monks like me. Because, you know, you're not enlightened. You're just a young monk. Only give it to the great teacher, the Ajahn Chah, because you get more merit given to an arahat than to other people. So when I saw that, I understood why it is we don't let on who's fully enlightened, who's not. It could be just the little novices sitting in the back. They could be the enlightened ones, but we don't let on. So you have to give to every monk and nun as well. So no distinctions. We don't have any castes. Because you know what they call the enlightened monks? They call them Aryas in Buddhism, Aryas. And I said, if we let you know who the Aryas were and who weren't, we'd have what we call the Aryastocracy. And the riffraff. You know, so we don't have that at all. So that's why we don't say, but you know, it happens, you do remember your past lives. And I'll just tell them one of the past life stories, because these days you can get your past life through hypnotic regression. And there's one fellow over in Perth, and his brother was having some emotional problems, some addictions. And they tried a lot of therapy, and they thought maybe hypnotic regression might help. But before this man wanted to give this to his brother, he decided to try it himself. You know, just to see, you know, if it works and if it was suitable for his brother. And it was one of our past presidents who had done this as a hobby. And so, a very good regression therapist, a hypnotist. And he regressed this guy. And the first time he got a past life memory. It was just an amazing sort of fortuitous. And this guy, you know, he was working for the SAS. That's like the SWAT, the Special Air Services. He was on these maneuvers, really adrenaline pumped up, almost straight from this, like a terrorist exercise off the Perth, straight in to see this therapist, really high, a bit stressed, pumping adrenaline. And he said that might may be one of the reasons why he did so well straight away. And so he took him into hypnosis, and he recalled, he said, seeing the redcoats in Fremantle Harbour. Redcoats were the early English soldiers, and it's only a certain amount of time they wore those red coats. And he said, what were you wearing? He said, these brown clothes. And at first they didn't realise what they were. Well, who are you? And I forget exactly the type of person or the military he was, but they wore these brown clothes. These were people who volunteered, you know, from UK to come to Australia to look after, basically to be the prison officers for the convicts in the colony. And if they volunteered for 3 years of service, at the end of the 3 years, they'd be given a grant of land. And he knew all of this in under hypnosis. He never learned this before. I never knew this. And then he remembered, you know, where he met his wife in one of the pubs, his wife's name, how they met and how they got on together and where they married in a church in East Perth, and all the names. And then they got their grant of land in the south west of Western Australia. He did mention the town to me, but I can't remember it for the life of me. A small little town. And there, you know, they had so many children. Remember all the names of the children and where they died and where he died as well. And he had such very clear memory with all the names and details. And, you know, people keep those names and details here. It's in the Batty Library, for those of you in Perth. And he went there and spent hours in there and got all these details, everything checked out 100%. And he never believed in rebirth before. He was Australian, so Caucasian, a businessman, you know, and he thought, wow, this is incredible. And he said, you know, when that's you're faced with that, and you know, this is what you remember and you recall, a distant memory, and then you find out it all checks out. So he said, no doubt at all, that was me. He went to see the house where he lived before, and they got it wrong, because it was a heritage listed house, but the farmer destroyed it. So he took to the site and said, this is wrong, this is not the right place. And then he sort of said, it's up on the hill over there, that's where we built the house. And they went up there, and the ruins were there of this old house. And little things like that, you know, things which you shouldn't be able to know, you can recall. And so it's to him, it's no doubt at all that that was his past life. And the interesting thing, he came actually here, was sitting in this hall about 2 or 3 months ago, because he wanted to share this with the monks, but no one else, because he didn't want to be well known. He said it might affect his business over in Perth. And he said, one of the results of that, he said, now I know I lived before. Karma is so important to me. I have to come and give you some food. I have to give donations. I have to keep the 5 precepts now. I just can't not keep the 5 precepts. You know, and so, you know, he was an Australian, go and have a drink every now and again. He can't have alcohol anymore. He said, I just can't do it, because, you know, I remember, you know, past lives. This is actually absolutely true. So, you know, he's taken it from what was once like belief or faith in Buddhism to know this is damn true. And so he said, I've got to keep the 5 precepts, whether I like it or not. And I'd be very careful, he said, what I say to other people and not get angry at them. So when you actually remember your past lives like that, it has a huge effect on you. It actually just, you know, shows you this Buddhism business is not some fake religion, not just based on belief. It's absolutely true, and it has consequences. It just really sort of makes your practice so much more important. And that was the result. It's a very interesting case. Unfortunately, that a lot of time in our culture here in Australia, maybe the same even in Hong Kong and Indonesia, if someone comes up and says that, you get a lot of jealousy, a lot of people point fingers at you, say you're crazy, and so a lot of people just don't want to bring it out into the open. But the truth of the matter is, it does change people's lives. Which is one of the reasons if you do that, it will just make your whole life totally different.